headlines this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the enemy has launched a multi-front invasion against the country, urging authorities to respond accordingly. Iran's top security official slams the U.S. administration's continued maximum pressure campaign amid the Vienna talks on removing anti-Tehran sanctions. And Beijing condemns the latest planned U.S. arms sales to Taiwan, saying that it seriously undermines China's security and sovereignty. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the enemy has launched a multi-front invasion against Iran, from politics and economy to security, media, and diplomacy. Ayatollah Khamenei said facing such a vast invasion, Iran cannot always maintain a defensive strategy, and officials need to deliver a multi-pronged security, economic, and media response. He also noted that Western powers claim to advocate the freedom of expression, will resort to media dictatorship to censor social media posts about Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's anti-terror commander, whom the U.S. assassinated in a drone strike. The leader said that Western powers would place a media ban on every word or image that runs counter to their policies, but use the same platforms to unleash destructive offensives against Iran and the Islamic Republic. He also said the U.S. is taking a blow from where it least expected, adding the previous and current U.S. presidents have joined hands to further disgrace Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with a group of commanders and staff members of Iran's Air Force. Scholar and political commentator Saeed Hosseini says the U.S. does not comply with any international law or agreement.
We are dealing with a country which does not have no respect to any international law, having a president who unilaterally comes and disagree with not only this agreement but a lot of other international agreements which Trump didn't respect and came out of this international agreements. Well, having all of this history in mind, Iran has got all rights to consider the measurements by all means to actually save the future of this agreement and also the possible neglection of United States again after signature this time. So that's why the Supreme Leader has actually introduced measures and has expressed his precautions and give advices to the team and both sides what to do to protect the Iranian rights. I think that's the one.
Iran's top security official is urging the U.S. to drop its maximum pressure campaign, just as the eighth round of negotiations on the revival of Iran's deal is set to resume in Vienna. Ali Shamkhani says the current U.S. administration has been trying to achieve, with empty promises, the goals that former President Donald Trump failed to achieve through bullying. The official believes, with Washington harboring illusions, the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 accord will not be fruitful. Iran and the P4+1 group are set to recommence discussions in the Austrian capital today. Iran's foreign minister is hoping that a final deal will be sealed in the coming days. Hossein Amir Abdollahian has urged the West to be realistic and to take effective steps towards the removing of sanctions. And just as the parties involved in the Vienna negotiations are preparing to take up the talks where they left off, bipartisan divisions continue to prevail in the U.S., with dozens of Republican senators warning President Joe Biden they might block any new nuclear agreements with Iran. In a letter to Biden, a group of 33 lawmakers have said that they would thwart the implementation of any new accord if his government does not allow Congress to review and to vote on its terms. The group of legislators is being led by Senator Ted Cruz, a longtime opponent of the Iran deal. They have threatened to use the full range of options and leverage available to ensure that the Biden administration would adhere to U.S. laws before reaching any new deal with Iran. Journalist and political commentator Abbas Aslani says U.S. officials remain split over what decisions to make on dealing with Iran, while Tehran has completely clear positions on issues such as the lifting of sanctions.
The Iranian team has achieved a conclusion and now has a clear agenda on those four issues of lifting of the sanctions, verification, guarantees, as well as the nuclear issue. They know what to do, and I was hearing from a source close to the Iranian negotiating team that the Iranian team has made its decision. They know what to do now. But they were concerned that the United States has not made a political decision yet. Because what we are hearing from the United States is not a, let's say, united voice. You see what is happening in the Congress, what is happening between even among the Democrats themselves. U.S. Chief Negotiator was expected to attend a hearing session in Congress on Wednesday. If that happens, that could be one day after the talks are resumed in Vienna.
People in Indian-administered Kashmir still have fresh memories of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. As Sayed Ali Safi reports, people in the Himalayan region hail the Islamic Revolution for promoting the culture of Islamic unity and resistance against oppressive forces.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic, and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching the Iran Revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice, and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayed Ali Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Israeli forces have attacked the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, killing at least three Palestinians inside their vehicle. We're now joined by our correspondent, Mona Kandil, for an update on the situation. Mona, what led to this unfortunate event?
Well, what happened, and according to the footage that we have got, it was that Israeli forces were in a Palestinian vehicle, a mini van or mini, car, that's used by Palestinians usually as a taxi or for transportation. Israeli forces stopped in the middle of the street in front of another Palestinian car, and they killed the three Palestinians were in this vehicle inside the Palestinian neighborhood of Al-Makhfiyyi in the central of the Nablus city, known as the occupied West Bank. They killed them and they left. Later, the Palestinian Ministry of Health confirmed the killing of three Palestinians in Nablus city, describing what happened as an assassination by the Israeli forces. After that, the Israeli intelligence forces issued a statement saying that their troops raided the city of Nablus in order to apprehend or to arrest a Palestinian group who are accused for carrying out shooting attacks against Israeli forces and against Israeli settlers in the last 2 weeks. And there were clashes between the Israeli forces and those Palestinians. Then they killed them at the spot. However, at the same time, the Israeli military statement added that none of the Israeli soldiers were wounded in this operation. So at the end of the day, it's an assassination. In the middle of the day, Israeli forces raiding a Palestinian city, killing people in cold blood, and claiming that they were wanted for security reasons and that they are involved in a number of shootings against the Israeli soldiers and Israeli settlers in northern occupied West Bank.
Yeah, I have a couple questions about, the first of all, the manner that this was killed by the Israeli forces. Did they just come point blank and shoot at these three people and kill them?
Well, it seems, according to the that yes, Israeli forces were in a Palestinian transportation vehicle. They left this vehicle exactly in front of another Palestinian vehicle where the three militants were inside it, and they killed them. Of course, those who took the footage of this assassination were normal Palestinians from their homes and their balconies, and they when they heard the noise of something weird is going on, they took these videos and they record the after of the assassination, not the same time when the Israeli forces killed the three Palestinians. However, there were footage very clear showing Israeli forces with their fully armed in front of a Palestinian vehicle in this neighborhood, and it was clearly that blood was seen from this vehicle. Immediately after they left Al-Makhfiyyi neighborhood, Palestinians rushed to the area, and they saw this massacre where three Palestinians were inside their vehicle, killed in cold blood. Then the Palestinian Ministry of Health confirmed the death of those three Palestinians, who all of them are from the city of Nablus.
Sure, and again, I'm trying to make out this crime scene that you're describing. From what I understand here, when they killed these three people, the Israeli security forces, they left the scene, and that's when then Palestinians came in to see what was going on regarding what they saw. Obviously, were three dead bodies.
Well, yes, when the Israeli forces were in the middle of the neighborhood, were in that let's say it's empty. There were no one there but Israeli forces and the Palestinians' vehicle, in addition to the other Palestinian vehicle that the people there say that the Israeli forces were using it in order to carry out their crime. Because usually Israeli forces, when they raid Palestinian cities, they enter in their armored vehicles, their jeeps, fully armed, and then clashes take place between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But this time it was an undercover operation when a number of Israeli forces raiding the city of Nablus inside a Palestinian vehicle, and when they spotted those three Palestinians whom the Israelis claim they are part of the group who were shooting at Israeli soldiers, they stopped the vehicle they were in. They get out and they open their fire at the three people without allowing them to leave the vehicle because they were still inside their vehicle and they were shot inside it.
Thank you for that. Mordechai Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Many thanks. Moving on, China issues a stern warning to the United States over its plans to provide up to $100 million worth of arms and military services to Taiwan. The Foreign Ministry says the arms sales would seriously undermine China's security and sovereignty. The ministry says that Beijing will take robust measures to protect its security interests. Taiwan, however, has welcomed the U.S. move, saying that the deal will take effect in March. Washington has increased its military support to Taipei over the past years amid rising tensions with Beijing. China considers Taiwan as an inseparable part of its territory and has warned Washington that it could trigger war by further pushing the island territory to seek independence. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
Pay attention to this fact, that the Islamic Republic is an Islamic government and its flag is the flag of Shi'ism. But even in the Islamic countries where Sunnis are living, sometimes people express their interest in the Islamic Republic. They express their interest, advocacy, cooperation and support. In many countries from East Asia to West Africa, there are those who look at the Islamic Republic in this way. But they are not Shia. Therefore, in the Islamic world today, the Islamic Republic is a manifestation of Islam, of the Islamic nation, and of the sovereignty of the Islamic nation. As I mentioned before, in countries in which many Sunnis live, the people held large demonstrations on the anniversary of the martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani. Therefore, we should not think that we are entitled to show negligence towards national solidarity. Of course, there are other points that I have mentioned before many times. For instance, boosting hope and looking to the future. This is one of the important issues of our time. There are some individuals who try to undermine hope in the youth and try to make them hopeless, distrustful of the future, and think that there are no prospects for them.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is our duty to strengthen hope in their hearts. Boosting hope cannot be done by just talking. It should be done by working hard. And the country's officials are thankfully busy and active. They should pay attention to the fact that many of their positive deeds can fill the hearts of the youth with hope. Their actions can fill the youth with hope and make them hopeful. When youth have hope, they will work well in various fields, they will study, and they will conduct research. One of these positive actions is preventing some people from taking moves in the opposite direction in trying to cause the youth to lose their hope. They do this using different temptations in the internet and other media. Another point is that we must not allow the achievements of the Islamic Republic to remain hidden. This is one of the very important issues. Well, we have economic problems today. For example, there are the problems of inflation, the expensive prices of some goods, the people's livelihood, especially the underprivileged classes, and problems with our banking system, taxes, and the like. Well, these are our problems. Some describe these problems as if nothing positive has happened in the Islamic Republic and they conceal the achievements.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and a scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief, as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic act. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said, "We demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal." That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantees that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the US and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a U.S. ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there, Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. You know, in Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters. That, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time, Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, short answer to this is it's called misdirection, or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate the pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded. China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale. Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The list of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there. What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encourage the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization, as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police, known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA, its main aim to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with a strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his White Revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. But he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years. But popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at the high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son, Mustafa, at the hands of Savak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic Revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
Congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: من صبر صبر الأحرار وإلا سلى سلو الأغمار.
Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, one should endure like free people. Otherwise, one should keep quiet like the ignorant.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, dear friends, when we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that one of the things that Imam Ali really focused on and emphasized in his life, and likewise he paid great attention to, was the Day of Judgment. We see that the actions of Imam Ali alayhi salam are geared towards that day. For, as we all know, it is on the Day of Judgment when we will all be answerable for our actions, for what we did and for what we didn't do. So here, one of the interesting things that Imam Ali alayhi salam says about the Day of Judgment, he talks about what is the worst provision, what is the worst thing to take with us to the Day of Judgment. So, you know, we might think that there are certain things which really we should not take. And of course, any kind of sin and any type of sin is something that we should not be taking with us, right? So whether it's lying or cheating or backbiting or gossiping or physically, spiritually hurting someone, being mean or being a bully, things along these lines. I mean, you know, sins that we know, drinking alcohol or non-mahram relationships. These kind of things, these are all sins, and of course these sins are taken with us to the Day of Judgment, and we are all held accountable for these things. One of the things that we must do, and we must do in a timely manner, and this was spoken of in another program, is the timely confession of these sins, right? As soon as possible, we should confess to ourselves and confess to the Almighty Allah, and feel regret and remorse and shame and ask for forgiveness from Allah for these sins that we have committed. So like we were saying, the worst provision, of course, is a sin. But here Imam Ali alayhi salam, he tells us what the worst provision is on the Day of Judgment. His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, says, the worst provision for the Day of Judgment is to oppress the servants of Allah. Now here, of course, the first thing that is understood from this statement is that one must not oppress the servants of Allah, the worshippers of Allah, those who are the sincere ones and are close to Allah, right? And so I think it seems fitting here that the more an individual is the servant of Allah, and the more an individual is close to Allah, for example, the Messenger of Allah, or Imam Ali himself, or Lady Fatima Zahra, and if we go down the line, these saints of Allah, and if we go further down the line, the great scholars of Islam, and even the regular Muslims, These all fall under the servants of Allah in one shape or form or the other, right? The Messenger of Allah being the greatest servant of Allah, and a regular Muslim being farther down the line as far as being the servant of Allah. One cannot, one must not oppress the servants of Allah, right? And it makes sense. I mean, first of all, in general, we should not oppress anybody, whether they are a servant of Allah or they are not. But when it comes to an emphasis, we must definitely, definitely not oppress those who are close to Allah, those who are the servants of Allah. We must respect them, we must honor them, we must give them their due status, all the way from the Messenger of Allah to the infallible Imams, to the Ahlul Bayt, to these religious scholars, the ulama, the maraja, the sources of emulation, all the way down to the regular Muslims and even people in general. For, as Imam Ali says, the worst provision for the Day of Judgment is to oppress the servants of Allah. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
When we talk about Imam Ali alayhi salam, the question is, how do we tackle the topic of Imam Ali alayhi salam? It is very difficult in itself because of the great personality that he was. And when we look at the fada'il or that which has been said about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that we are at a lack of or a loss of words. For example, we get a tradition reported from Imam Radha alayhi salam where he says, no one can complete their faith. That means faith is incomplete unless they give the same respect to the last of us as they do to the first of us, to the imams. You can't say that one imam is more hujjah than another imam. He says, faith is incomplete unless you give each one of us our due respect as being the authority of Allah, as being the proof of Allah, and as being the ones who decipher that which is halal and haram. But he says, however, the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam are on a different level than us. This is from Imam Raza alayhi salam, where he says, the fadail that is deserved or deserving to these two great personalities is different than the fadail that we have. And when we look at the ahadith, we clearly understand that Imam Ali alayhi salam is in a position where there is nobody with him. Yeah? Except, of course, the Prophet is greater than him. We get a tradition, for example, from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, where he says, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, afzalu khalqillah ghayri. He says, Ali ibn Abi Talib is the best creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala after me, he says. The best creation. This is coming from the best of the creations. And he says, wal hasanu wal husayn sayyida shababi ahli al-jannah. We know this. That Hassan and Hussein are the sayyids, the kings of the princes of Jannah. But what he says, wa abuhuma khayrun minhuma. What their father is better than them, he says. Now this is a pretty big honor. Now it clearly defines for us that even within the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, there is a hierarchy, you can say. That of course the first is the Prophet. You know, there's one rule that we always have to understand. And if we understand this rule, then our aqaid becomes easier. We find so many ahadith which describe the fadail of Imam Ali alayhi salam, saying he's the best at this and the best at that and the best at this. But he himself says, Ana abdun min ibadir Rasul. I am a servant from the servants of Rasulullah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Welcome to Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. An electrifying direct action campaign is sweeping through Britain. The target, Israeli arms firm Elbit Systems, which produces drones and arms which have been used against innocent Palestinian civilians. Through a fascinating alliance between the local community and activist group Palestine Action, Elbit successfully chased out of the English town of Oldham in January. Today, we'll be focusing on the anti-Elbit campaign and exploring ways to capitalize on these victories. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report that looks at the campaign which forced the hand of Elbit in the sleepy town of Oldham.
Elbit Systems is Israel's largest arms manufacturer. At the end of 2021, it had 10 sites across the UK and 4 subsidiaries. Today, it only has 9 sites across the UK and only 3 subsidiaries. This is the story of how an activist group, in tandem with the local community, courageously stood up and shut down an Elbit Systems arms factory in the British town of Oldham. The fingerprints of Elbit Systems can be found everywhere, from Israel's drone killing of 4 Palestinian boys playing football on the beach in 2014, to the apartheid wall in the West Bank, which the International Court of Justice has deemed illegal. From the anti-migrant infrastructure in Arizona to Kashmir occupied by the Indian Army, Elbit Systems shareholders are always the profiteers. UK-based activist group Palestine Action has launched a relentless campaign to shut down Elbit factories in the country through direct action. They claim to have carried out almost 100 actions in a year, causing almost £20 million worth of damage to Elbit's operations. Their defense is that criminal damage to stop war crimes is no offense. There is yet to be one conviction of Palestine Action activists of any crime in British law. They claim Elbit Systems is afraid to follow them into court, where the reality of its operations would be discussed openly.